Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Now, Monday night, yeah, not so much. In fact, if I'm being transparent and honest, Monday was pretty horrible. Because for a long time, it looked like it was going to be a really good night. It looked like the Chargers and the Dodgers were both going to follow up the Lakers with big wins of their own. Then it all went to hell for both. Why don't we start with the LA Chargers? Last night's game in prime time against the Saints felt like a coming out party. Another coming out party for Justin Herbert. I mean, if for some reason you did not know why the Chargers made the rookie their starter, you do now. He went 20 of 34, 264 yards, four touchdowns. The rookie had four TDs on a Monday night. He staked his team to a 17-point lead over an alleged contender. And the guy looked good doing it. He looked great. A nine-play, 80-yard TD drive on the team's first possession. The only slight blemish on that drive was the fact that LA missed a point after. But it's a long game. They went right down the field on these guys. That was never going to matter, right? In the first half, LA was dominating, and the Saints were playing, well, they were playing not just bad football, but football that was not smart. In fact, I'd go as far as to say the Saints were playing dumb football. Bad penalties, bad throws, blown coverages, an all-pro missing a big game because he allegedly punched a teammate. I mean, dumb. Ugly. Bad. About as ugly as that idiotic roughing the punter penalty that let the Chargers keep the ball on their second TD drive. I mean, the Saints look like hell in the first half. Then you had this INT from Drew Brees.
Your own 22. Brees steps and throws, and it's intercepted. It is picked off. Nasir Adderley down to the 15, the 10, and will just come up short.
Drew Brees, he's trying to fit this ball into the tight end, but the ball floats and goes back. That's just a force by Drew Brees. You get frustrated. The offense isn't in sync off the bat, and you force it as an interception.
Man, that was ugly. Really ugly. The Saints' offense is really pretty strange right now. And that's putting it nicely because it's not what it's been. That offense is not nearly what it's been. And sure, part of that is Michael Thomas not being on the field due to injury and punching a teammate in the head, reportedly. I mean, I'm going to argue he's their best player. You lose that and you're not going to be the same. That's a given. But just getting this guy back does not mean they're going to return to what they've always been offensively. Namely, that explosive unit that keeps opposing D coordinators up at night. Because they're no longer that. They're still dangerous. They're still effective. They still have weapons. But they're not that high-octane unit that they used to be. Playing the Saints offense used to be one of the scariest things in football because you knew they were going to test you every single way possible. They were going to hit you deep. They were going to gash you on the ground. You just hoped that you didn't get run out of their gym and straight humiliated. But again, that's no longer the case. And if you're on Twitter during the game, you're seeing two names pop up constantly. Alvin Kamara and Taysom Hill. As in, keep feeding one guy and stop feeding the other guy. So, following the Brees INT, the Chargers were up 17. Being up 17 on the road against a future Hall of Fame quarterback is nothing new for Herbert or the Chargers. I mean, they were up 17 last week in Tampa against Tom Brady. But then it fell apart in the last 32 minutes. Last night, though, man, last night was different. Last night felt like a step in the right direction. Last night felt like a step forward. You know, go on the road in prime time with your rookie quarterback who's getting better every single day, and you make a statement. The statement being, we are different. We are growing. The worst is behind us. We are going to finish games right here, right now. It is our time. It all stops now. Oh, excuse me. My bad.
Excuse me. My bad.
Because they're still not ready for prime time.
My bad, my friend.
Still not capable of finishing a game, my friends. My bad. My bad. Because it all fell apart again. The Saints score before halftime. They make it 20 to 10, Chargers. But then the Chargers seem like they decided, you know, we'll just nap it out in the second half. They gave up a field goal on the Saints' second drive of the second half, and then this on the third drive.
Back to pass goes Breeze. He's in Charger territory, moves up, launches a long pass. He's got a receiver at the 10, the 5. It's caught by the tight end, Cook, and it's a touchdown. It's a touchdown. Drew Breeze has just thrown a 41-yard touchdown pass.
You know those golden pipes belong to Kevin Harlan and Westwood One. Now it's tied at 20, and the feeling on the sideline had to be, oh, hell no. Here we go again. Uh-oh! I don't know, except maybe with that young slinger under center, maybe things are different. And then, with less than 4 minutes to go in the fourth, they've got a 3rd and 10 from their own 36. They're staring at a 3-and-out and handing the ball back to the Saints to take the lead. Except Herbert did this.
Shotgun snap, drops back 5, got the block from the right tackle, throws long down the sideline. Oh, he's got his receiver, Williams, down the sideline, 20, 10, 5, he'll walk in, touchdown, touchdown! A 64-yard touchdown to a wide-open Mike Williams of the Chargers.
Wow, two huge mistakes right here. First, they only rushed 3 guys, so they dropped 8 into coverage, and Robinson was the right corner over there, and he just let Mike Williams run right past him as if he was expecting safety help. Where were you?
It's correct, my guy, Kevin Harlan, but correction, not wide open, wide ass open. That was maybe the easiest touchdown Herbert is going to have in his entire NFL career. Like, I've got no idea what Patrick Robinson and the Saints was doing on that play. I said it earlier, I'll say it again right now. That is just not smart football. You can't leave a guy that wide open on 3rd and 10. You can't leave somebody that wide open on any down and distance. I mean, I thought for sure Robinson must have fell down. The guy certainly must have been injured. That's the only way a guy gets that open in the NFL. That wasn't the case. That was just another mental breakdown in coverage. So now the Saints are down 7 with 3:44 on the clock. They need to go 73 yards to tie that game. And sure enough, they do. Because Charger fan, I hate to say it, you knew they would. You knew they would, just as you knew they would cap it off with something like this.
Taysom Hill is in the gun. He brings his receiver in motion. He fakes the handoff. He runs to the near side. He pump fakes. He runs from the 10 to the 5. He's in for the touchdown. Taysom Hill runs it in. A touchdown by Taysom Hill running over the right tackle.
And that was for everybody on Twitter crying about Taysom Hill being wedged into the offense too often. So LA gets the ball back. They've got 52 seconds to get in field goal range. And I'll be damned, but the kid does it. And he does it with this perfect pass to Mike Williams.
3rd and 1 from the 39. Shotgun snap, the drop back of 5. The time by the line. Throws long down the near side. Leaping attempt to catch. It's caught. It's caught on a leap on the near side at the 31-yard line by Williams. He caught the ball in 8 seconds to go. Losing his helmet in front of the Saints bench on the near sideline in what was an acrobatic, leaping, two-handed, backpedaling, falling down catch.
I'm telling you, into double coverage to a spot where only the receiver could get it. A hell of a throwing catch. One hell of a throwing catch. And remember that rap on Herbert coming out that maybe the guy was too mellow. Maybe he was too laid back. Maybe he was too quiet to be an NFL quarterback. You know, all that crap. Remember all that junk? Yeah, I don't think that's the case because this guy is built for it. In big moments like that, as a rookie, he is stepping right into it, making the right play, a big play, giving his team a chance to win. Now it's down to the Money Badger for a 50-yarder to win the game.
The snap is good. The ball put down. The right-footed kick is away. It is end over end. It hits the upright. No good. He hit the upright. It's no good.
Oh, my goodness. I thought it was just going to hook back inside the pole. Wow.
Doink! That is the sound of Charger fan being stabbed in the heart yet again. And not like Tyrod Taylor getting stabbed in the lung with a needle. That is the sound of Charger fan getting stabbed in the heart yet again. I mean, there was plenty of leg. The Money Badger just was not money in that case. Plenty of leg, not enough accuracy, and of course, you couple that with missing the extra point earlier, and you've got a nightmare game for the kicker. And at that point, Charger fan knew how this was going to go. You knew it. You've lived it. You do live it. The Saints were going to go down and kick a field goal in overtime, which they did. And then the Chargers were going to make it as close as they possibly could to winning without actually winning, which is what they did, because it's what they always do.
Here they come, back to pass. He throws a line drive pass, leaping two and catch by Williams right at midfield on the Fleur de Lis. At midfield, he's close to the first down. I don't know that he's got it. Let's see where they spot the ball. The Saints have emptied their bench. They think they have stopped him, and they have. They put it down short. Fourth and seven pass, brilliant catch by Williams, but short by the length of a football. He did not get to midfield, and Drew Brees and the Saints have come from behind to beat the Chargers in overtime, 30-27.
If you're a business owner, you do not need me to tell you that running a business is rough. You know this, but you might be making it tougher on yourself than necessary. Do not let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down any longer. It is time for you to upgrade to NetSuite. Listen to me. Stop paying for multiple systems that do not give you the information that you need when you need it. Man, ditch the spreadsheets and all that old software that you've outgrown that is so outdated. Upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, your HR, your inventory, your e-commerce, and everything you need all in one place instantaneously. So whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue, you need to save time and money, and you can do so with NetSuite. Join the over 21,000 companies that are using and loving NetSuite right now. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/Rome. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/Rome, netsuite.com/ROME. Alvin, can I get one more? Aww. Because that was a huge play by Marshawn Lattimore. That is one massive dude that he took down with the game on the line. You expect Williams to win that battle every single time. Not last night. Yeah, I know, Charger fan. You were not expecting him to win that battle on that play, because that would have meant that you were going to win the game, and you do not win games like this. And I hate to say it, but you are right. The last 2 years, the Chargers have lost 13 games by one score. 13. And when I say the last 2 years, I'm talking about 16 games last year and only 5 games this year. So we're not talking about 2 full years. They somehow have lost 13 of those games by a single score. How does that happen? How is that even mathematically possible? They had 9 one-score losses last season. And then you think, it can't get any worse. It can't get any more devastating. It can't get any more heartbreaking than that. Oh, yes, it can. Because they've already lost 4 straight one-score games this year. You couple that with the trend of awful injuries, and the Chargers seem like they might be cursed. Except I don't believe in curses. Never have. They're not cursed. Man, they are this close. This close to being a good team. This close to being even a really good team. They just need to break through. Maybe even just once. Maybe you find a way to win even one of these games. You find a way to finish even one of these games. And then everything changes. Maybe. But we'll never know until they do it, and they haven't. And the problem is, they're getting worse, not better. Now, the good news is, it can all change in a hurry. But only if they learn to finish. And it's something they better learn stat, because it's getting late in a hurry. And I'm really not sure how much more of this the Charger fan can take. Especially LA Charger fan. Inglewood! Burbank! Long Beach! Pasadena! Hancock Park! Woodland Hills! Studio City! Alhambra, Marina Del Rey, Van Nuys, North Hollywood. I want to hear from you. How much more of this imbecility and aggravation can one man take? Dan Fouts ain't walking through that door, Charger fan, and neither am I. Hell, I can barely walk at all. I want to hear from you. Why can't they finish? Is it this this, what do they call it? Epidemic? Or is it a pandemic? Whatever. San Diego, do you want them back? React to me. I don't have much time left. On the planet, I mean. Sing it with me. San Diego. Hey, 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 hey. Remember that Super Bowl run back in whenever that year was? Best time of my life, man. The Bolts were good. I was the play-by-play voice. I got to watch Rome work his magic every day. Sing it with me, everybody. San Diego. John Carney would have split the freaking uprights. Stan Humphries ain't walking through that door. Neither is John Freeze. Give the rock to Natron Means, for crying out loud. Touchdown, Tony Martin would have taken matters into his own hands. You know it, and so do I. And now so does the entire San Fernando Valley. Wow. This ticker can't take much more of this. Man, I'm pissed. Brian Kelly is my guest. Brian, nice to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you on. So you're coming off that 16-point win over Florida State on Saturday night. That was your first game since September 19th. Let me start right there. Going into the game, what kind of expectations did you have, and did you have concerns about how the time off might impact the team?
Yeah, I think the expectations were that, you know, we were going to have some moments of adversity, and that we, you know, were built to overcome them. So, you know, just, you know, there are a couple of instances. You know, the first series, Kyren Williams fumbles the football, and, you know, our defense, you know, holds them to three. But the next series, Kyren comes off and rips off a 65-yard run. So, you know, knowing going in that there were going to be some hiccups, and hanging in there with our guys and showing confidence in them, I think that was the most important thing, that we trusted them. We had some time off. We were going to have some mistakes. We weren't going to be perfect, but hang in there, and we'll get this thing you know, back to where it needs to be after we get some plays under our belt.
Notre Dame head football coach Brian Kelly, my guest. You mentioned Kyren Williams. He and Chris Tyree had enormous games. They both had 100-yard games. In fact, Brian, the offense rushed for 354 yards. Like, when you've got the kind of experience that you seem to have on the offensive line, and then you add a couple of tight ends who really enjoy blocking, does it feel like that level of physicality is at the core of this group's identity overall?
Yeah, and that's what we wanted to go into the season is try to, you know, shape who you are. And, you know, to have these five guys back, obviously, is who we are. And they played a lot of football. You know, they played in the you know, the BCS playoffs 2 years ago. They won 11 games last year together. So this group of five players is, you know, as good as I've coached as a unit. So let's lean on them and create our identity with this group. And so far, it is who we are. And add some depth at the tight end position and two outstanding running backs, and actually a third that rushed for over 100 yards in Cebu Flemingster. So, you know, it's really a deep group that we can count on week in and week out.
We're talking to Brian Kelly, and then on top of that, you throw in wide receiver Javon McKinley, who had five receptions for 107 yards. Afterwards, you made the point, quote, he's a beast. He just needs to think that way more often. I think he's starting to think that way, end of quote. So, like, you're chuckling about that, but as a coach, how do you go about helping a player realize the kind of upside and potential he has, and how much of that is just about a mindset for that player?
Well, that's what I'm trying to create. You're absolutely right, is that he has to come in with that mindset. You know, we believe in him, but he's got to believe in himself. And, you know, he's such a great kid, and I want him to be a great kid off the field. But on the field, I want him to have that mentality that he can't be stopped. He was going up against a really good corner in Asante Samuel Jr. He's going to play on Sunday. He's a really good player. And he can go up there and he can win those battles against a player of that caliber. He needs to start thinking in those terms. And so, you know, part of our job is to get those kids to understand that they're gifted. He's a kid out of California, surveyed high school. He had an incredible high school career, and he's been slow to getting to that level here. And some of it's just a matter of carrying that mindset, and I think he's doing that now.
We're talking to Notre Notre Dame head coach, Brian Kelly. You know, Brian, I've spoken to a number of head coaches for the past month and a half, and almost to a man, they've talked about how emotional they were after the first game of the season because of all the work that everybody had to put in just to get to that point, but also all the uncertainty that they dealt with in terms of not knowing if there would even be a season. What was the experience like for you overall, and what have you learned from it?
Oh man! Well, we had two seasons, really. You know, we started the season and then we shut it down and didn't play. And so, you know, I just think that, you know, the ability to have emotional flexibility is more important than anything else. In other words, that things are going to happen and you've got to be able to adjust emotionally more than anything else, because the protocols and procedures and you know, the new normals, if you will, you have to have emotional stability, because if not, you're going to be out of sorts. And I think that that's what it teaches you more than anything else, is that, you know, you have to really calm yourself down and really look at, we're dealing with playing football during a pandemic, and some of these things are out of your control. And I think once you do that, I think you have a better sense of what you're doing every day.
We are talking to Brian Kelly for a few more moments. Well said. So initially, you were getting ready for a schedule which included facing Navy in Ireland, Wisconsin at Lambeau, USC in Los Angeles, and so much more. Then the schedule changes a lot due to COVID. And then you joined the ACC for a year. So what's that part of the process been like, and are you embracing conference membership for the year?
Yeah, I mean, we are. I mean, we're very fortunate and very humbled that the ACC has given us this opportunity to be part of, you know, full-fledged membership, if you will. You know, all of our other sports, obviously, are full members of the ACC, so we've had this collateral relationship with them. But, you know, to be able to play for an ACC championship, to be able to, you know, fulfill our schedule, the ACC, you know, has made us whole from that standpoint, and certainly we're very grateful. But it's been different, you know, because you're now in a situation where, you know, you have an opponent each week that you've got a better feel for. When you're an independent, there are different schools that you're playing for the first time. And so there's a little bit more of a comfort level in understanding who you're playing each and every week. And so our guys, I think, you know, understand that the opponent is someone that they're much more familiar with from week to week.
Brian Kelly, my guest. And then one of your former players, Chase Claypool, had an enormous game on Sunday for the Steelers. He had 7 receptions, 110 yards. He had 4 total touchdowns. Having coached him, are you at all surprised by the way he has shown up on the next level? And how much pride is there then when you see players have huge games on Sundays?
Yeah, there's a lot of pride. I mean, we've got 10 guys that made NFL rosters from this team from last year, and nobody really talks about it. But, you know, we're proud of the development of our players. You know, nobody knew who Chase Claypool was, and, you know, all the other guys that, you know, have got bigger resumes. He's a young man out of Canada that, you know, that developed, and we thought that he was going to make an impact. And, you know, he's a humble kid, and he has, you know, obviously made an impact early on, and he'll continue to do that. He's a matchup nightmare. You can play him inside. You can play him outside. You can hand him off the football, and he's well-grounded, and he's well-prepared for the success that he's going to get in the NFL.
So, Brian, before I let you go, one quick thought on your staff. You've got Mike Mickens, who played for you at Cincinnati. He joined the staff in the offseason. You've got Tommy Rees, who played for you at Notre Dame and was promoted to offensive coordinator this offseason. What do you make of the job that they've both done, and what's it like to have former players on staff?
Well, they're just, you know, first of all, unique in that they have such a great knowledge of the game, but also incredible interpersonal skills, the ability to teach, communicate, relate. That's what today is all about when it comes to coaching in any sport. Their ability to relate with their players, and they do such a great job of relating with their players and interacting with, obviously, the staff as well. So to have Mike on staff with the corners, he's doing a terrific job with a bunch of freshman corners, and And Tommy Rees is doing a great job in the leadership role that he's in. So very blessed that I've been in this game long enough that I've got players now that are able to be part of the staff.
Notre Dame, 3-0 on the year. They are number 4 in both polls, and they're at home against Louisville on Saturday. That is a 2:30 p.m. Eastern start. Brian Kelly, of course, the head coach there. Brian, great to have you back. Always good to talk Notre Dame football with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Take care.
We are joined right now by Jake Odorizzi of the Minnesota Twins. Jake, it is nice to have you on the program. Good to have you, Jake. How are you?
Absolutely. I'm doing good, Jim. How about you? Nice
good.
To talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again. Listen, I want to get your thoughts on the latest news involving the LA Dodgers and the fact that Clayton Kershaw can't go. But first, when we get into the ALCS and NLCS, Jake, overall, what's going through your head when you're watching postseason baseball? What do you make of what you've seen so far?
The thing that jumped out at me so far is the home run. It seems like there's a lot of runs being scored via the home run. So if you can limit hard contact, a lot of those teams have been winning these ball games. And I think a good example of that was the Rays the other day. They punched out, I think, 13 times as a team, but they hit 2 home runs and they came out on top with good pitching. So opportune hitting, I think, has stood out to me a lot. But we've seen a lot of really good pitching as well this postseason. So I think those are the two big things right now is we're not seeing a lot of at bats put together and, you know, adding runs on. It's coming off of one swing. So that's good and bad, but that seems to be the theme so far this postseason, at least from my point of view.
We're talking to Jake Odorizzi of the Minnesota Twins. All right, Jake, the news just broke that Clayton Kershaw is not going to get the start tonight in game 2 of the NLCS. He's got back spasms, and Tony Gonsolin's going to start in his place. If you're in that Dodger clubhouse right now and you're down 0-1 in that series and Kershaw can't go, how big of a blow is that?
Hopefully a minor one. Hopefully the temperature inside the clubhouse has at least an understanding of what's going on with him. And, you know, I know he's dealt with this in the past. And, you know, he's a Hall of Famer. I mean, there's no cutting around it. When that guy's not going to go on his scheduled start, I mean, I think it catches you off guard first off. But if he's, you know, talking to him, seeing how he is, hopefully he's able to start tomorrow for him because, you know, you need that guy out there to do what you want to do, get back to the World Series again. So hopefully it's just a minor thing. I think we saw Max Scherzer deal with the same thing last year, missed his start. They thought he was going to be out, and the next day he's out there pitching. So hopefully it's the same thing because they need him. And it was a tough loss for him last night. I thought Walker pitched really well with his history of blister issues. I thought he would perform pretty well because that's a tough injury for a pitcher. It sounds weak and, you know, very soft, but that's the most crucial part to a pitcher is the last bit of your finger touching the ball because that's where you get all your feel. So, you know, hopefully he's okay, and, you know, Kersh will be out there tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm glad you explained that it's not just a blister. Like, you know, most listeners or fans are like, come on, man, I got blisters. I go to work. I still go on my runs. I still go to the gym. Yeah, not the same thing. Not the same thing. Listen, when you talk, you've talked about this too, the fact that Kershaw has made this transition at this point in his career where he's found a way to dominate even when his stuff has changed, and we've seen this from other power pitchers in the past. How impressive is that to you, and what's that process like when you're a guy and as you get older and you change and you evolve, you've got to make use of what you have and still dominate?
Yeah, I think there's that low point. You almost switch up your routine a little bit, and it seems like guys that, you know, like Kersh, for example, obviously he's been elite his entire career. His low is better than a lot of people's highs. So there's always that. That's a good thing, but what I've noticed with certain guys like a Verlander, Kershaw, there's a little bit of a lull, and then they come back to the form that they were beforehand. Maybe the velocity is just a little bit down, but they add velocity. They get the feel back for everything. Sabathia did it. A lot of those good guys, they make adjustments, and they find out what they need to do to be successful because the competitor in them is not going to let them take a lesser, you know, outing to the mound, lesser stuff to the mound, and be okay with it. So that's that drive. That's that tenacity. And He's definitely got a lot of that. So I think that's a lot of the driving force when it comes to it. But you got to figure it out yourself, and then you start going on the uphill again. I think this is some of the best I've seen him, you know, pitch in a couple of years, and it's just been consistent every single time out. And when you've been that guy for years and hitters know what's coming and you're still dominating them, that's the mark of a true ace and Hall of Famer.
Jake Odorizzi is joining us. He's a starting pitcher with the Minnesota Twins. Jake, I'm glad you mentioned routine because you and Rich Hill talked about this earlier in the year, and you asked Hill what it was that made Kershaw so special. He said it's his routine. Like, why is that so important to a pitcher and to that one in particular?
So routine is just what, you know, if you've lasted this long in the big leagues, you have a good routine that you've worked out that works for you personally. Every routine is different from player to player. You know what you need to do to prepare and get yourself ready. Some are longer than others, some are shorter than others. But as a creature of habit, it's a good thing to show up each day knowing what you're going to be doing, as opposed to when you're younger and you're still, the soreness doesn't exactly set in the same. You're young, you're, you know, low 20s, you can just show up and go out, play catch, and that's your day. But as you get a little bit older, it's nice to have a game plan going into each day as, okay, I know day two I'm doing this, day three I'm doing this, day four I'm preparing for my start day. And just knowing what you do when you show up to the yard is just it's a let off your shoulders, just because you're not sitting there wondering, okay, what should I do now? I feel like I'm wasting time, you know, everything like that. So good preparation, you know, breeds, you know, good results. So when you can get a routine like that on whatever you need to feel comfortable as yourself, that's the most important thing that I've learned over my career, and that's put me on a good path.
I wonder, Jake, like, how much of that would work for any of us in any walk of life? Like, for instance, as part of your routine, how much of that stuff and how often do you find yourself not wanting to do it, but just because of discipline and because of repetition and consistency, you just make yourself do it, and then when you make yourself do it, generally things work out pretty well?
Yeah, it's kind of that snowball effect. Is you make one good choice and you roll over into the next one, and then halfway through your day, you're in a really good spot. You're like, man, this is great. And then a couple of days of it becomes a habit. So I think routines are, like you said, it can be implemented in any walk of life. It doesn't matter if it's sports, everyday business, you know, teaching, whatever it may be. If you have a good solid routine, it really takes the stress is out of a lot of things. Of just as simple as like laying your clothes out the night before you wear them, you just wake up, you put them on, as opposed to wasting 10 minutes early in the morning. And who knows what you could do with that 10 minutes. I realize that's a small amount of time, but just things as easy as that is a starting point. And, you know, people who have kids, they understand how hectic things can be in the morning time. So something like that in the morning could make a day go by a little less hectic, you know, who knows. But, you know, that's just my views.
Oh, I agree with you, Jake. I'm not sure, and I think other people listening also understand this. Like, hey, Jake, let's not get started on the importance of making your bed. You and I both know that's important, too, but I'll save that for another conversation, maybe the podcast. Now, what about the Braves? They're 7-0 in the postseason. They're obviously playing with a ton of confidence right now. How much does each win add to the confidence for a group like that, and how dangerous do they look to you?
They look phenomenal. I think they're doing everything well. Their offense is coming through. Their bullpens look really good. Their starting pitching has been pretty elite. I mean, it's a good place to be if you're a Braves fan right now. And the funny thing about them, too, is they have a young core for the most part. And I think this is kind of a glimpse of what the future holds for them. If they can, you know, obviously keep some of these guys around, bullpen pieces, that shifts a little bit. But, man, they're playing some really good ball right now. And it just seems like they're at that point now where each day somebody new is delivering for them, and that's a dangerous team to face when there's not one guy or two guys in your lineup that you can. I mean, we all know who those, you know, couple guys are. You want Acuna and Freddie are pretty special at the top, but when those guys aren't the ones hurting you and it's somebody else, that makes a well-rounded team, and that's what you want to have in the postseason.
We're talking postseason baseball with Jake Odorizzi. Jake, what about the Rays? Like, if anybody is surprised that they're two wins away from a World Series, then either they haven't been paying attention or they just don't really understand the sport. But this is not surprising at all. Not if you watch these guys. You were with the Rays from 2013 until before the start of the 2018 season. What was that time like for you, and how would you describe the culture of that organization?
So just the starting point of that, it really helped mold my career, put me on a good path. I learned a lot during my time there. And, you know, I was fortunate because they traded for me. They saw something in me when I was with the Royals. They liked the high fastball, the rise ball effect, pitching up in the zone. But that was before that was a popular thing. So they're always ahead of the curve when it comes to analytics and kind of what the next it thing is in baseball. So at that time, you know, we're seeing it now is elevated pitches in the zone are kind of what's been focused on. And I was doing that back then, and they saw that, they liked it, and we started it back then. So they always have an eye in the future and knowing kind of what the next trend may or may not be. And they really encouraged that from me when I got there. So they tried to make what I did better than what it normally was, which is, you know, big detriment to where I'm at right now in my career. But, you know, they thrive in situations where it's unexpected, it's a crazy thing. And obviously this year of a 60 game season and everything that's gone along with it, I feel like that's right in their wheelhouse. They have endless arms that come out of the, you know, come out of the bullpen, start for them. And the way they use guys is probably second none. No other team really uses their whole lineup and pitching staff as they do. So they've all got this experience this year, and they're looking very comfortable, and I don't blame them whatsoever. They're playing really good, and they're pitching really great, and I think that's two of their big keys. Plus, their defense has been phenomenal. Just that last game against the Astros, I think they made about five or six plays that are usually not expected to be outs. And if you can shorten the game in any of those aspects, you're going to be in a good spot. So I'm not surprised in the least bit.
Hey, Jake, really quickly, I think that's a really interesting story that you tell. Like, if you understand analytics and you understand metrics and you understand the way the Rays go about their business, that's not surprising at all. That they saw you, they knew the kind of stuff that you had, and they knew that you had that high fastball in the zone, that rising fastball. That's not surprising to me, and especially you know where the game is going. I'm curious, when you were doing that, were you mindful of that? Was that just kind of the movement and the mechanics that you had, or were you doing that intentionally? Did you know that you were doing that and having success and that would be a value to somebody?
Yeah, so that was something that I've always done. It's just been natural to me for whatever reason. It might be my hand positioning on how I throw, whatever it may be, but I was having success like that when I was in the minor leagues with Milwaukee and Kansas City. And in the minor leagues, it's a lot different of scenario of, you know, you kind of listen to what they say, and it's always get the ball down. And I could do it, but I was way more effective and had way better results when I was just kind of cutting it loose and doing what came natural to me. So I tried my best to do that, and I got to a point, I think about in AA, that I just said, look, I'm having success with this. I'm okay with, you know, doing what you guys want, but I think it's hindering me a little bit. And then I just got to the point where I did what I needed to do, and lo and behold, you know, 10 years later, it's worked out pretty well. And that's just kind of knowing yourself, though, at the same time. And if you're not the type of person that can do this, then obviously it's not for you, and it could be a little throw you off the rails a bit. But just a decision that I made that I thought I knew myself pretty well, and fortunately I did. And then you have a team like Tampa who comes in and says, we love what you're doing. We don't want you to change a thing. We actually want to make it better. And that was such a huge thing for me to hear somebody just like what I'm doing and tell me why that I'm having success. Because before that time, there was no why to that. It was just, oh, you know, it's going to run out at some point. But they had the reason why, and it made complete sense to me after I got there.
See, again, I think this is kind of amazing. Like, for instance, you know how there are certain organizations and they do things a certain way and they've got a certain philosophy and they'll bring in pitchers and treat them the same way, and this is the way we do it. This is the way we attack guys. This is where we are in the zone. I mean, it's one thing for you to make adjustments after you're 5 years in, 8 years in, 9 years in, as you are right now in the major leagues. But when you're in the minor leagues and you're trying to make it and you're in an organization and they're telling you to do it a certain way, like, I wonder how you had the wherewithal and the belief in yourself to say, yeah, you know, respectfully, I don't think that's the best way. Like, how did you know, and how did you have the fortitude to say, no, I'm going to do it my way because I really think it's better?
Oh, first and foremost, like, I tried doing what they wanted me to do. I gave it good effort to do it. It was just very foreign to me. They wanted me on the opposite side of the rubber, which I normally pitch from, and then pitching down in the zone, which the angle it created, I understood their mindset behind it, but it was very difficult for me to get on top of the ball and consistently be down in the zone. So it was a little bit of a back and forth for a while, and then just after talking with them and explaining my mindset and everything like that, it was, I think they understood a little bit, but maybe still didn't like it. But the results kind of spoke for themselves, and there was at one point in my career, I won't mention where or when, it was along those lines of, you know, if you can't pitch down the zone, you'll never pitch in the big leagues. Mm. You know, words that were told to me. And, you know, at that point, I was like, I think I might disagree with that. I didn't say that. I was thinking it to myself. But, you know, thankfully, yeah, everything's worked out pretty well from the decision that I made, because it could have been a crossroads, you know, in a career at any point, and it was a big step. But I just felt like, for me and my future, that this made the most sense to me, and this has been years of success doing it. And then thankfully Tampa came along and explained to me like the whys, and then I got to really study the why and go beyond that point, and that's kind of where I am today. So, and I think a lot of teams, that's their model now, is we want guys to go north and south more so than east and west. But things change yearly, and it seems like they're always changing. So that's just kind of a little bit of background of how I got to be the type of pitcher that I am.
I'm glad you shared that. That's actually very helpful. And you're right, things have changed. And teams do see it that way, but they didn't see it that way at that time. All right, so finally, you're entering free agency, and you're doing it at a really unusual time after a really unusual season. How are you approaching it?
I think about the same as last year, to be quite honest. You know, obviously this year was a weird, strange year for everybody, but for me in general, it was especially strange. Without back to routine and habit, spring training, normal spring training is a huge tool for me. I'm fortunate enough that I can use it as a tool and not have to fight for a spot anymore. And I like to go throw against the minor leaguers in spring training. I don't really like to pitch in big league spring training games because I want to work and I want to, you know, work on whatever I'm focusing on for that season or the adjustments or just ironing things out, getting my feel for things. And I like to do it back there where it's a controlled environment, everything like that. Well, this year I wasn't able to do that. So it was kind of a learning on the fly all over again. And it was tough to not have the feel where you want it to be when the season starts with, you know, we had 3 weeks of ramp up time and I had a small issue that set me back a week, but a week at that point was almost like a month with a short time frame. But it was a tough start to come off, and I just felt like I was playing catch-up a little bit. Arm physically was perfectly fine. Everything lined up with what it was last year. Just the execution was a hair off, which is, you know, easy to kind of work through in a long season. It's that's what, 6 months for a reason. But, you know, finally get back, get my legs underneath me, and then I catch a line drive to the chest from an ex-teammate of mine, and that sets me back, and then a blistered end the season. So a lot of things are just unexpected. I can't really do anything about that. It is what it is. But at the same time, when I was out there pitching, my numbers analytically lined up with where they were last year. So I'm still the exact same pitcher I was, and I don't think there's any reason to think anything different than that. It's a If those four starts for me would have been zero runs, would I have been asking for $200 million? Absolutely not. So I don't really see how the reverse effect of that should be in play. But I realize, you know, people view things different ways, and that's just the way I view this. I think I'm at a great point in my career, and I think my best years are ahead of me with the training that I put in and the, you know, velocity increase that I've been able to maintain at, you know, this point in my career. So I think there's a lot of good things, and a lot of my best years are going to be ahead of me. So that's just my view on it, and I expect there to be a lot of interest, and we'll go from there once the market opens up.
There it is. Finished off his ninth MLB season, already an All-Star, already a gold medalist, the 32nd pick overall back in 08. Jake Odorizzi, my guest. That's a great baseball conversation. Jake, I appreciate that so much. Thank you very much for coming back on. I know we'll do it again soon, and good luck with everything.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it. Before we get off here real quick, I remember the last time we talked, Tampa Bay Lightning got 4-outed, and this year they won a Stanley Cup. So I think we need to talk just about every year around the end of the hockey season. And the reverse effect couldn't have been more apparent this year in a upside-down world. So I just thought I'd bring that up to bring things full circle for us from the last time till now.
There is some symmetry in that, to be sure. Hey, listen, are you craving some protein after a good workout? Don't make a shake or eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why? Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty, it's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. And Old Trapper is a family-owned business that takes smoked beef very seriously. You can taste it in every single bite. Like, who wants dried out, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal. It comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, which is sweetened with a touch of brown sugar goodness, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy for those of you who want to shake things up. Next time you want to grab a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Be sure to look for Old Trapper. It's in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, clones, ask for it by name, because no other beef jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? You've got the Bills and you've got the Titans. Bills, Titans. And it's coming to you live from Nashville. Live from Nashville. Both teams have cleared the protocol. That means we have a green light. And we're here because of what happened, of course, to the Titans. And there's been a lot of moving around, shifting around, waiting around, trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen. You had Tennessee and Pittsburgh, but that game has been rescheduled for later on. That Sunday fight between the Mafia and the Titans moved to tonight. So finally, Tennessee is back on the field. And lots of questions. Like, Tennessee has not played since September 27th. How ready are they going to be? Not only have they not played since September 27th, they have barely practiced since then. And they're missing a few key guys. against what looks to be a pretty damn good Buffalo Bills football team. But as we will learn all season long, there are going to be teams that are shorthanded. And outside of everybody's health, which should be the top priority, as long as they're going to play these games, people really don't want to hear the excuses, right? At the end of the season, nobody's going to be asking, yeah, but what about Tennessee? What about what they had to go through? It's tantamount. It's important. Safety and health should be number one, but the league is pushing through, and they are playing these games. So, bottom line is, you're going to look up the scoreboard. What about the matchup itself? How does that look? As of right now, you've got both teams that are stacked with wins. Neither team has an L. Yes, we've got a battle of two unbeatens in October. That's true. The Titans, for all the issues they've had, they're still unbeaten. They're 3-0. Bills Mafia, you are 4-0. Mafia, you have a chance to go 5-0 for the first time since 1991. And yes, I'm sure some of you are pissed about how this all played out. Some of you are mad about how the Titans handled the outbreak and the protocol. Some of you are mad about how your game got moved from Sunday. However, Mafia, don't lie. You also see this as an opportunity because you want to showcase to the rest of the world exactly what you have. You want everybody jumping through your tables or through tables over your 2020 Bills, your 4-0 Bills, because you feel like this year is different, that this group is different. You're feeling it, and you want everybody's full attention locked into you. Eyeballs on your Super Bowl contending squad this evening. I know you, Mafia. I know you want to showcase that well-balanced squad. And oh yeah, the fact that you've got a quarterback who is not only improved, but a quarterback who is right in the middle of the MVP conversation. Your guy, Josh Allen. And after Russ Wilson and Patrick Mahomes were not exactly on their A games on Sunday, deep down, I know what you're thinking, Mafia. You're thinking that this is an opportunity for Josh Allen to help his campaign, for everybody to see how much better he is right now, for all eyes to be on us and our guy. And you know what? I don't blame you. I see you working. As of right now, Allen is right in the middle of that early season MVP conversation. No, he is not Tom Brady, like the old gunslinger tried to suggest.
Josh Allen will be the new Tom Brady.
He said that. That guy said that. Yeah, I don't know about that. That might be a bit premature. However, he is playing his best ball to date. And when most fans and coaches were hoping that Josh Allen might be a little bit better, might take the next step, might further develop this season, this guy has done the proverbial shock the system as opposed to making an incremental improvement. This is a different player. This is a different guy this year. This is a guy who's taken a gigantic middle finger and flipped that bird to anybody who said, yeah, let's just get a little bit better. Let's make incremental changes, because he has leapfrogged all reasonable expectations. In other words, to quote the great Jameis Winston, he's balling now. He is balling. Allen's got 12 touchdowns and only one INT. How's that for decision-making? He's also averaging over 330 yards a game in the air, a better number than Russ, a better number than Pat, an even better number than Aaron Rodgers, who is off to an amazing start. So my question is, who is really cooking? Hey-o! Hey, that's not a shot at Russ. I would never take a shot at Russ. I've got mad respect and admiration for Russ. That dude's mind is in neutral, and he is excelling. That's just a shot at the phrase, the well-overused phrase, let Russ cook. I mean, it was okay for a minute or so. It just jumped the shark, like everything else, because everybody is saying it. Everybody. Look, we all agree, this dude is Bobby Flay right about now. Cool. Hell, even Peter. Peter himself has finally come around to how good Russ is. Just quit saying, let Russ cook. Anyway, back to tonight. Josh Allen. He's got a new weapon in wideout, Stephon Diggs, going up against a banged-up Titans secondary. A defense that really has not played that well this year, despite the fact that they are unbeaten. And Diggs is not Allen's only weapon, as you and the Mafia know. But he is his best. And you have to think he's going to have some opportunities. He's going to have a big night tonight. Diggs will have a big night tonight. Honestly, though, it seems to me what this really comes down to is the Bills' defense. Like, make no mistake, through four games, the Bills' identity has not been their defense as it has been in recent years. It has been their offense. When was the last time you could say that? Now, their defense is not bad. It's just not the same type of defense that Sean McDermott has had in Buffalo or what you're accustomed to seeing. So now would be a very good time for that defense to get right, especially on the back end, because we all know what they're going to face in the Titans. Ryan Tannehill is playing good ball once again, but the team is still going to run through Derrick Henry. All 6'3", 250 pounds of Derrick Henry coming at you downhill. Can the Bills D contain him? The last two times they've met, they have. But then again, as I mentioned, that Bills or those Bills defenses were different than this group. So, Mafia, I'm trying to find a way to get you in here for some Tuesday night ball. The stage is set. We keep hearing from you how awesome you are. Now the entire world will be watching. You've got yourself a captive audience. I mean, what are you competing against? Some baseball? You've got a captive audience. The nation will be watching. Their peers will be watching. And now we're going to find out and see for ourselves what your quarterback looks like. Is this a typical Bills sprint in a marathon where they get run down from behind because they gas out, or is this really different? Mafia, you're on the clock.
The clock.
Man, it's some Tuesday Night Football on CBS. Everybody is going to be watching. Eli Drinkwitz is my guest. Eli, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing great. I am awesome. Now, you and I spoke before the season, and then you go right out and you beat LSU on Saturday. I do want to get into some of the details of that win, but before I do so, overall, man, how does it feel to have your first win in a new job be a win over the defending national champs?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of those things I'll look back and reflect on probably later in my life or in career. Right now, I was just so excited to get a win and what we had to fight through to get it, and how awesome it was in that locker room for not just me, for the players and the staff, the amount of time and effort and energy we put in to try to get that result and then to get it the way we did. You know, I haven't really looked into the significance of what it is, but just enjoyed that.
Eli, you mentioned the locker room. So what was that like? What was it like to come back to the locker room after that game and shouting, "We are," and having your guys shout right back at you, "Mizzou"?
Yeah, I mean, it's just powerful. You know, these guys have sacrificed a ton. I've asked them to make a lot of sacrifices, and our coaches have asked to make a lot of sacrifices, you know, just to even have an opportunity to play the game. And then when you have to play the game, and sometimes you feel like the deck is stacked against you when you're, you know, you got guys out because of COVID, you're playing your third top 25 team, you haven't had spring football, to come out with the result that nobody expected, the locker room's it's just an awesome celebration. It's the best party that you can ever have.
Eli Drinkwitz joining us. All right, so to that point, let's be very clear about this. You were starting a redshirt freshman at quarterback, who I'm going to get into in a minute. A redshirt freshman at quarterback. You were missing two starting receivers, three of the top four defensive tackles, a couple of key backups. I mean, knowing that, it would be really easy for guys to think, man, we do not have a chance against the defending champs. So how would you describe the mindset of the team going into that game?
Yeah, this play mentality. You know, we talk about this play matters the most. And it's the only thing in football that you can control is how hard and how much effort you put into this play. And you don't worry about, I got to put in 65 plays, because really all you got to worry about is this play. And that's our mentality. Don't ever worry about the previous play or the final score. You just focus on this play and do your job to the very best of your ability on this play. And do that all game, and you never know what the result's going to be. And that really was our mentality. I mean, you could hear them when they were doing the review, you know, on the ball that was cut short on the 1 yard line. Nick Bolton's yelling to the defense, "This play, this play, this play," and we just did that for four straight plays, and we won the football game. And that's when you know that you got a chance to be a good football team. You know, the craziest thing is our starting X receiver in the game was a walk on in January. We had open walk on tryouts. He came. Our director of recruiting said, "Hey, coach, there's this young kid.
we watched him. We said, yeah, we'll let him, you know, be on the football team in the spring. And he starts and has five catches for 50-something yards against LSU.
Eli Drinkwitz joining us. That's wild. That's a wild element to this.
Yeah.
And then again, we are talking, though, about the fact that you had to go with a redshirt freshman, Connor Bazelak, as your starting quarterback. Now, you said, quote, it's his opportunity. Like, what did you see in him to let you know that it was his time and that he was up to the task?
Connor's a great competitor, and he's got some – I mean, he's just got some moxie to him. He's got a natural skill set throwing the football. But he had played in a wishbone offense in high school. And wishbone's a tremendous offense. It's just not exactly what we're running with our pro-tempo stuff. So, you know, his senior year, I think he had less than 200 attempts throwing the football. So for us, you know, we're running curl flat concepts, and he's kind of thinking in his mind, you know, I know how to read the defensive end on Veer, coach. Curl flat, that's a totally different concept for me. And so, and not to have spring, it took him a little while, and it's still taking him a little while to just learn and grow confidence in our offense. He's got the ability, but quarterback's all about having confidence and understanding the defense does this, this is my answer. The defense does this, this is what I got to do on this concept. And so we're still learning and growing, and he's got a bright future ahead of him. I'm extremely proud of Sean Robinson. He was just a tremendous teammate all week. Didn't pout, didn't have bad body language, was awesome, and was excited for us, and is a great quarterback himself. But it's just Connor's opportunity.
You know, Eli, I was going to ask you about Sean Robinson, but I thought you'd beat me to it, and you did. I mean, after the game, you did talk about him, and you said just that, that you were extremely proud of him for the way he handled that. I mean, what's it say about him that he took this path and that it did not go the other way? Because for so many other young players, it would have gone the other way.
It just talks about, I mean, his parents have done a tremendous job raising him. It talks about what kind of character he has. And it goes back to what I said earlier. It's a this play mentality. All you can really focus on in life is what's in front of you right now. And that's all you can control. And that's the mentality that he's taken. And he knows at some point he'll get another opportunity. It's just, what are you going to do between? Are you going to prepare for that opportunity, or are you going to be CD, which is blame, complain, and defend? And he chose to focus on this play, this opportunity, put all my focus into it, and it'll work out for him. He's going to be a real success story in life just because he has that mentality.
You like, go back to that BCD. What does that mean?
Blame, complain, and defend. When something doesn't go your way in life, you can do one of two things. You can either own it and get better, or you can BCD, blame, complain, and defend. You blame poor performance, you complain about breaks just didn't go your way, or you defend bad behavior. We just don't do that.
Eli Drinkwitz is joining us. All right, so you end up losing the turnover battle in that game 3-0. Obviously, you're not excited about that. But what's that say about the group, that you lose that turnover battle? What's it say about their mental toughness that they can do that and find a way to overcome and not flinch?
Well, first off, it says we're going to run some gassers today. Turn the football over. But again, it goes back to the mental toughness and focus component. You know, usually teams get divided. The defense starts pointing fingers at the offense, or the offense starts pointing fingers at the defense, you know, when there's turnovers or when there's touchdowns. I mean, at one point we were down 24-14, didn't flinch, went down there, tied it up. The very next play, the defense, you know, LSU threw a 75-yard bomb for a touchdown. Nobody flinched. They just went back out there and said, hey, let's just keep playing this play. And when we look at the scoreboard, it's going to turn in our favor. And that's how it played out for us.
All right, so you mentioned the end of the game. Let me go back to that really quickly. You score with just over 5 minutes left. You take a 45-41 lead. Then LSU goes on that long drive. They've got first and goal from the one-yard line with 37 seconds left. I understand the one-play mentality, but what's going through your head at that point?
Well, I knew they were going to tempo the inside zone with no edges. That's their MO. So we had a great call on. We knew we could bring edge pressure and try to condense it as long as we got in our gaps. You know, the thought process was there was a coach on the sideline saying, coach, we should use a timeout to save us some clock if they score. And I said no, because I've been in that situation before. They had no timeouts. They've got to get their four best play calls called, and they got to do it with that time breathing down their neck. When they didn't get in on first down, you figure they're going to try some sort of run. They did. Didn't work. Third down, you knew had to be a pass. Otherwise, the clock would not stop, and they would be without the game. So, you know, I think if they had it to do over again, they may not have called those same plays in succession. But for us, we kind of knew what was coming. It was kind of the same succession of plays they ran against Alabama. last year on in a similar goal line situation. The difference was the running back was able to get it in. But they ran the exact same kind of screen crack play for their tight end, and we were able to knock it down. And then fourth down, I mean, just a great play by our senior safety, Josh Bledsoe.
So when you're building a program, how valuable is a win like that? And the ability to point to the win is evidence that the process does work if everybody buys in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key to it is continually keeping it going. It can't just be a one-and-done moment. You know, it's got to be, okay, this stuff works, all right, but that doesn't mean we just sit here and go pat ourselves on the back the rest of the week. It means today we go in there and we address the fact that we had too many turnovers and we had some mistakes and things that we got to fix. You got to build and continue to ride the wave, ride the momentum, and that's really what we're going to try to do. I do think it tends to get people to understand that this isn't just talk. You know, talk's cheap. Everybody wants to see they want to see the action. They want to see the results. And so far, we've been able to give them one result, but one is not nearly enough. You know, at Mizzou, we plan on winning the SEC East, and that's the goal. That's why we're here, and we got a long way to go to get there.
He is the head coach at Missouri. So one last thought. Initially, you were supposed to play Vanderbilt this weekend. That game has been postponed. What's your reaction to that news, and how much does that change how you approach this week?
Well, it totally changes how I approach the week. The week has now become self-reflective. Where can we get better? You know, we've played three top 25 teams. We're going to play a fourth top 25 team in a row. And so how do we improve? How do we get our guys healthy? And then can we get refocused on our academics? You know, this is midterm week for us, so it comes at a good time so guys can really focus on their studies. My initial was, you know, when it happens, the first thing you do is want to make sure that everybody at Vandy's safe and okay. I mean, we are facing a pandemic that is worldwide, and so it's not really about, you know, that stinks that we can't play football. It's about first making sure that all the players and staff at Vandy and get healthy, and we send them our well wishes. And then once that gets taken care of, then we'll resume the world of football.
Let's go to Southeastern Wisconsin. Chris. Chris, what's going on with you?
Hey, Jim. How you doing, buddy?
Good, dude. How about you?
I'm doing great, man. Hey, while I get the chance, early happy birthday to Garrett and also you, Jim. I hope you two boys really enjoy the day.
Finally.
Real quickly here, Jim. As a dude from Southeastern Wisco and not a Dodger fan, I still felt compelled to speak up about Clayton Kershaw. No true fan of America's favorite pastime gives any credibility to these dim-witted and immature Twitter clone ass pipes. The closest they have ever come to competing is in a slow pitch softball beer league where any dude that can manage to get a bat around his 8-month pregnant looking gut can get his hacks in. Yet they think they are experts on toughness. It disgusts me, Jim. The latest hate for Clayton Kershaw from the LA Dodger bandwagon Twitter geeks just further cements my theory that social media is littered with immaturity, ignorance, and corny tweets. Calling out the future Hall of Famer about his heart and toughness is ridiculous. Kershaw has pitched 13 years in the league. He's an 8-time All-Star, 3-time NL Cy Young Award winner, National League MVP. And get this, clones, he has a career ERA south of 2.5. And lastly, Kershaw has a hits allowed per 9 innings of just under 7. That's good for second best in the history of Major League Baseball, you idiots. Any Dodger fan that doesn't think it kills this guy not to be on the bump for game 2 is an absolute moron. Now I see why you don't like reading 99% of the tweets you get, Jim. It's a bad look for the show. I wish these L.A. trolls would walk west until their cheesy fedora hats and vape pens start floating in the Pacific Ocean. Or Jim and Garrett finally shooting some hoops in Ritz driveway together after the show tomorrow to celebrate their mutual birthdays. And or Logan Rome and his rocket scientist-like knowledge of high-end cocktail ingredients. Deuces, Jimmy!
Make that 9 or 8 or 7 or whatever the number is. This guy gets automatically racked every single time.
Rack him!
Good night now!